From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Today, we talk trash.
I'm the trash man. I come out, I throw trash all over the ring, and then I start eating garbage.
We'll tell you what Atlanta's doing to modernize its trash pickup system. Find how one program in the city takes our food waste and turns it into compost for farmers. But first, we asked for your gripes about the worst driving habits on Georgia roads, and here are your first thoughts.
This is Edward Austin Hall calling from the gorgeous but automotively dangerous Beecher Donnelly neighborhood. Atlantans, you do not live in London. Please stay to the right side of the center line unless some city official is directing you to go around. People cross the center line to park on the left side of the street all the time, and guess what? It's illegal and it's dangerous. I almost got run over by somebody driving on the left side of the road.
Carly Cooper tweets, I hate when people in the left lane drive so fast, don't give you the chance to get over to the right lane, then come around you. Neil Cassidy says, we are the worst at using that little lever on the left of the steering wheel. Maybe the newer vehicles don't have one? They do have one, Neil, and you're right. People don't use their turn signals. Gosh darn it. We always want to know what you think, even if it is a rant. You can call us at 404-500-9457. We're on the Twitter. It's at OST Talk. And remember, we might feature your comments on the air. Now let's talk some trash. Some cities across the country have turned to a software-based trash pickup system. The city of Atlanta began doing this at the start of the year in partnership with a waste management company called Rubicon Global. The company says this smart trash model cuts costs for the city and helps combat climate change. I talked about this initiative with Stephanie Stuckey Benfield, who's Atlanta's chief resilience officer. I also spoke with Rubicon Global's Michael Allegretti. Michael joined us by Skype, and I asked him how software can change the way we pick up trash.
Well, you know, you can't improve what you can't measure. So at the end of the day, this is really about moving this industry, the waste and recycling industry, out of the dark ages and away from a landfill model, which is an opaque model, where knowing how much waste you produce, when it's produced, and what's in it isn't advantageous to the business. Moving away from that to a model where citizens and governments and businesses actually understand how much they're producing and where the opportunities are to recycle and reuse materials, not just to help the environment, but also to make money. So at the most basic level, data and analytics and transparency help to move us away from landfills and towards a greener future.
Stephanie, what does that look like in realistic pictures on the streets of the city?
Well, first, let me just make a quick correction. I've had a change in title. I'm now Chief Resilience Officer for the City of Atlanta as part of the Rockefeller Foundation. And the resilience program includes sustainability. I did want to give that quick change. So there will be no discernible difference for the regular Atlanta homeowner as to how their trash is picked up. What the Rubicon Global Project brings for City of Atlanta residents is that we are going to start measuring at a real granular level our trash and our recycling. And as a result of that, we hope at the end of this six-month pilot study period to come up with some solid recommendations for how we can be more efficient.
Meaning you're going to measure how much really belongs in a landfill, how much is recyclable. You also know how much people are recycling as opposed to throwing into their garbage?
That's right. And the cool thing about this technology is right now we have data based on quadrants, which is how we schedule our pickups. So we have different pickup days for the different quadrants.
Divide the city into squares. And
exactly. Yeah. So we just have quadrant level data. This gives us data per individual household. And especially what we need to know is who's recycling.
I got to stop you again. You know, if I live in Atlanta, you're going to know whether I'm recycling or not?
That's right. And we're not trying to be the trash police. What we're trying to do is encourage people to recycle. And we can't really target the homes where people are not recycling unless we know who's not recycling.
Right.
So this data is going to enable us to be more effective in our communications and our outreach strategy.
How do you do this, Michael? I mean, how do you know which addresses are recycling? Because they all get thrown into the same bin, right? I mean, how do you separate people's trash by address?
So the tech, think, is it's app-based tech. So essentially all 60-plus Department of Public Works trucks in the city of Atlanta will be outfitted with our technology on a smartphone. And the principle of the tech is interaction by exception. That's what's so cool about this company and about this technology. It was developed through the eyes of the men and women on the front lines slinging trash bags and driving trucks. So as the truck's rolling down the street, based on a number of things, and we have dozens of patents pending and approved, they combine GPS, the change in hydraulics of the truck, various shaking mechanisms, all these different triggers essentially confirm that a service has taken place. But if a driver sees something when he or she goes to remove the trash that's out of whack, let's say a bin that's contaminated or it's overflowing, they can actually record that in real time right on the app and have a digital record of that.
Stephanie, what other things can you imagine using this kind of, that's a lot of data, right? I mean, I would imagine there's a lot of different uses for it. For example, maybe there's a household that doesn't realize that you can recycle certain kinds of plastic and they were throwing them away. Is that the kind of thing that you can actually learn?
That's right. And so we want to be able to more effectively communicate to Atlanta residents what they should and shouldn't be recycling. So this data will be incredibly informative in that regard. We're also looking at route maximization. So are we really doing the most effective routing of our trash trucks? So that is the type of technology that Rubicon brings to the table. What's really innovative about Rubicon Global, unlike other trash hauler companies, is that they have a zero waste goal. They're not in the business of owning landfills and making a profit out of how much trash you can bring to the landfills, which is how most waste management companies make their money. Rubicon Global wants to divert waste from the landfills. They want to get more waste in the recycling stream. And so we're improving our greenhouse gas emissions and we're improving our quality of life. So we're really excited to be partnering with Rubicon Global. They're also, I've got to give a shout out for the City of Atlanta. They're an Atlanta-based business.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about trash, and I'm speaking with, tell me your new title again.
Chief Resilience Officer is part of Rockefeller Foundation's 100 Resilient Cities program.
That's a long title.
I know. But it's an exciting title. We'll have another show on that.
Stephanie Stuckey Benfield. Atlanta is the test pilot for a new software-based trash pickup system, and so we have Michael Allegretti with us from Rubicon Global, who developed that software. So, Michael, I have to think that I'm not the only person who is thinking, are we entering the era of the trash big brother? Like, how far is it? How far away are we from Atlanta knowing that I'm not recycling, that I just tossed my aluminum can into the garbage, and then somebody showing up, the trash police showing up at my door saying, all right, pay $5 for not recycling your Coca-Cola can.
All right, well, fair enough. You see, the issue is, right now, Atlanta already knows that. The difference is they can't communicate with you about it. They don't have the means to be in touch, to kind of track that, and to start to change your behavior for the better of the city. So knowing about it's one thing, but knowing about it and being able to do something about it is where the change is happening. And, you know, for us, this, as a company, the Rubicon Global story up until now has been one about small business empowerment. We have about 5,000 independent haulers across all 50 states, and we work with them to service small, medium, and big national customers who want more cost-effective and environmentally sustainable solutions for their waste. But now with Atlanta, the story evolves. It goes to a new chapter about government efficiency, smart cities, resilient cities, responsive cities. It's really about, if you're gonna have a tax dollar paid, you need to get the full value of that dollar back through a service. And I like to think that the Rubicon software in this partnership will kind of maximize the value of that tax dollar.
How do you make money doing that, though? Because, look, I can't even recycle my glass anymore because they said it's not profitable. So I have to throw glass, one of the most easily recyclable materials on the planet, sure, into the garbage. So how do you make money without using a landfill?
Celeste, a lot of that has to do with the messenger. If you're speaking to a landfill company, and the big incumbents in the industry own dozens and dozens of landfills that they need to fill in order to be profitable. So the math for them isn't going to be the same as for a company like ours, who's out there basically looking at all of our customers and saying, give us your trash. As our CEO and founder, Nate Morris, says, trash is a tremendous opportunity. The key is to have a lot of it and to have it sanitized and then to sell it on the secondary markets.
Stephanie, what are some of the biggest mistakes people make with their garbage? Is it that they're not recycling all the things that they can recycle, or what are the biggest educational opportunities, I might phrase it that way, for the average consumer?
The biggest problem we're seeing is contamination and failure to recycle. So those are the two.
So you're not rinsing out their recycling items? Is that what you mean?
No, it's people putting items in the recycling bin that don't belong there.
Like batteries.
The number one, batteries is one, but the number one item that people throw in the recycling bin that they shouldn't, can you guess?
Styrofoam.
Plastic bags. Plastic bags.
Grocery bags, yeah.
Yes, people think that plastic bags are recyclable, and it's what I call magical recycling or wishful recycling. People think, oh, if we put it in there enough, eventually it will be recycled. The problem is plastic bags are not recyclable through our recycling system, and I don't know any city that does recycle plastic bags as part of their single-stream residential pickup.
But there are cities that don't allow plastic bags anymore.
That's right.
They want you to use reusable.
We're not there yet. I certainly encourage people to use reusable, but we're not banning plastic bags at the city level yet. That's not on our immediate agenda. For now, we're just trying to educate residents. If they would just keep plastic bags out of the recycling bin, that would be such a tremendous boost to us. We're showing in some quadrants up to 43% contamination, and most of that's coming from plastic bags and also food. The other thing is styrofoam, and you're seeing people throw cups, paper cups that are plastic lined. And so a lot of this is just education. In the past 2 months, Office of Sustainability has gone out and talked to every single MPU in Atlanta and educated them about what you can and can't put in your recycling bin. But that's only reaching a small fraction of the residents in Atlanta.
And the problem, Michael, with contamination is that it's so expensive to separate it out. Is that correct?
Exactly. It's just it adds a cost to the process, and then the math gets harder and harder to work in terms of making recycling sustainable. That's the key. So making, you know, we talk about sustainability, making cities more sustainable, but to make recycling more sustainable, it's not just kind of a green endeavor. It has to be a financially feasible one. And that means that at the front of the process, you need citizens and businesses to do their part.
So we only have a minute left, Stephanie, but the promise is that this program will cut costs for the city. How is that going to work?
Well, if we can hone in on how people are not recycling right and use that to help educate, then we're going to be able to get more people to recycle and recycle right. And that will improve our profitability. We want recycling to be a profit venture, which it should be for the city. And that saves residents money. They're spending less taxpayer dollars on their recycling program. And it helps save the environment and improves the quality of our air. I don't think people realize how much our greenhouse gas emissions are caused by landfills, because landfills produce an incredible amount of methane, which is actually more potent than carbon emissions. So there are many benefits to residents, from environmental savings to actual financial savings.
That's Stephanie Stuckey-Benfield. She's the City of Atlanta's Chief Resilience Officer. We talked earlier this year about Atlanta testing a new software-based trash pickup system. We also heard from Michael Allegretti from Rubicon Global, the company that developed the software. Just ahead, telling the story of Atlanta's first Black police officers. First, exploring the military roots of the food we love. It's on Second Thought. This is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. This time of year seems a pretty good time to thank our U.S. servicemen and women, active and veterans. But there's a reason to thank them you may not be aware of, and it could be on your table this Thursday.
Army food is no longer a matter of beans and guesswork. Since the last war, nutrition has become a science, and our Army Quartermaster Corps uses that science in planning Army meals. Food correctly used means fighting strength for our soldiers and better health for civilians.
That's a newsreel from the 1940s. Did you know many things we eat today were actually first developed for soldiers? That influence is especially felt in Southern food. Food writer Anastasia Marx de Saucedo joined us to talk about her book, Combat Ready Kitchen, How the U.S. Military Shapes the Way You Eat. I also checked in with Brunswick farmer Matthew Rayford, who's an Army veteran. Anastasia began by telling me why she wanted to explore the military's influence on the food we eat.
Oh, well, I have a little story about that, which is I'm a mom, and I pack a lot of lunches. And so one day, as I was putting together my daughter's school lunches, I got to thinking about the foods in them. You know, I had what I considered to be the healthy things, a sandwich, some carrot sticks and some grapes, and then the little less but healthy but child-pleasing things like the energy bar, a juice pouch, and some goldfish. And I started getting to thinking about the ingredients in the sandwich, and I said, these really probably aren't fresher or healthier than the things in packages. And then I started to do research on how the long shelf life was achieved for each of the items, each of the ingredients in the sandwich. And I found this reference to this obscure U.S. Army base, the Natick Soldier System Center. And I started to research on the Natick Center, and I found that it had been very deeply involved in 20th century processed food and now in the 21st.
So we're going to talk about some of the specific foods that you're talking about here. But Matthew, let me go to you as well, because you were in the military. What was your particular thing that you were always trading to get?
Well, I was that peaches and cream guy. I like peach cobbler, you know, so the closest I could get to it was to kind of add the peaches with the creamer from the coffee and whatever crackers I could and put it in, and as I hydrate it, it would become kind of like this mushy cobbler taste with the sugar packet.
You're talking about the powdered creamer, right?
Yes, the powdered creamer, yeah.
Oh, that does not sound appetizing, but... Anastasia, let me go back to you. Give us some examples of some foods that were first developed for the military and are now part of our everyday diet.
Oh, there are. I actually, in the book, at a certain point, I give a tour of the supermarket and I remove any item that has a military influence or origin. And at the end, I estimate that the store would be half empty.
Wow.
So it's pretty broad. I mean, you can start even in the produce section where those packaged greens and salads that you get are kept fresh using something called modified atmosphere packaging, which was developed to send produce to Vietnam. You can move on into the meat section where the Army actually was the first entity to cut meat off the bone at the point of slaughter and box it up. And then that actually happened in the First and Second World Wars. And then, you know, 40 years later, the Army developed a new form of animal protein, which is something called restructured meat. And those are basically the cheaper bits of meat stuck together with meat glue. And that became a staple in fast food restaurants. It's what the McRib is, and has also infiltrated the supermarket in the freezer section and the refrigerated section.
And Cheetos has a military grade, literally a military grade powder on it, right?
Yeah, the Cheeto is coated with cheese powder, and dehydrated cheese powder was developed during World War II because they were trying to reduce the weight and volume of food shipped overseas. They pretty much dehydrated everything, and when they got to cheese, because cheese doesn't have an internal structure, it just collapsed and turned into a powder. After the war, the little industry that had sprung up to create this dehydrated cheese powder then turned to the grocery manufacturers, and they soon began to manufacture convenience foods and snack items such as the Cheeto.
Or is that the same as the powder that's in Kraft macaroni and cheese?
I think it is.
I would think so. So, Matthew, you actually took one of the things you learned from military food, and that was meat preservation, did you not?
Yes. So the MAP process that that Anastasia was just talking about is one of the ways that we actually do some of our food here with sous vide. So basically what we do is we take those items, we season them, and then we put them in our machine that actually vacuum seals the bag. Then we take that bag and drop it down into water, depending on what the degrees that we're trying to cook the item in, and cook it that way. And then when we're getting ready to actually do the service, we take that item out of that package, sear it off, and then serve it.
I mean, I find it interesting, Matthew, that you have referred to the ways in which you've become a more creative
cook because of having been in the military.
Right, because there was always improvise, adapt, and overcome. That was always, I mean, that's one of the service mottos, right? So, you know, this is what you have. This is all the space you have to work it in. I think Anastasia just talked about the fact of, you know, they couldn't ship all of this food because of the weight. So how do we dehydrate it? How do we make it smaller? So,
yeah, pull the moisture out.
Yeah, you know.
I mean, I know I was engaged to a man who he used to do his cooking on the back of his tank because the exhaust is so hot.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I've done it many a times. I have warmed up beef stew that was inside and warmed it up off the back of the Bradley.
That's actually an excellent point because the military really has been the source of many food science innovations during the 20th century. And we can talk about things like freeze drying, so that gives you your coffee, food irradiation, which consumers didn't really like, but is used now routinely on spices and herbs. Something called intermediate moisture foods, which are kind of had all those soft and chewy bakery items that we eat. And right on up to the turn of the 21st century, when the military, working with a consortium of big companies, developed something called high pressure processing. I don't know if you're familiar with this, Matt, where you use all this pressure to kill the microbes inside food.
Microbes inside. Mm-hmm.
And that is people now buy as the refrigerated guacamole you can get at the supermarket, those single portion juices and smoothies, and many deli meat items.
So another thing that you mentioned, talk about in your book, and you kind of go into detail about it, is the development of active dry yeast, which I cannot imagine how people baked before they had that. How did this come about?
Yeah, that's actually a great story. And it was one of the things I was going to sort of mention for your listeners is there's actually a lot of items that we home cooks use that come from the military, and active dry yeast is one of them.
Mm-hmm.
Until the World War II, yeast had to be fresh, and because yeast is a live organism, and it was sold in moist compressed cakes that had to be refrigerated, and they only lasted for up to 10 days.
Mm-hmm.
At that time, the Army actually had a special unit of bakers who prepared bread in overseas camps, and it was very difficult to obtain local yeast. So the Quartermaster Corps began to research.
Oh, right, because they couldn't ship it.
Right, exactly. So they began to research how to preserve, basically to put yeast into a state of suspended animation. And they figured out a way that that involved a very long, slow drying that didn't stress the yeast organisms too much. And then they were able to rehydrate them months later and turn them into bread.
It's like they're putting the yeast to sleep because they can't kill it or it won't work.
Right.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
But Matthew, to a certain extent, all these things that she's talking about are kind of the opposite of what you do now with your life. They're talking about how to keep food and make it last, and you're all about fresh food.
Well, you know, how about this, though? Part of having fresh food, right, is having it seasonally. And how do you eat a tomato in the middle of winter? Well, what do? You make marinara. You make stewed tomatoes. And what do? You do canning. So preservation of food and preserving food is still a part of eating fresh food.
Some of the things that the Army is working on now they're trying to get a little fresher. What are some of the interesting developments going on in the military now with food?
The influence that the military had on processed foods after World War II, there was this core set of values that I mentioned, that they be imperishable, durable, affordable, and appeal to this broad range of palates. As you know, time has gone on, we've become much more aware of some of the health impacts of eating foods that have, to achieve those things, a lot of chemical preservatives or additional ingredients such as stabilizers, emulsifiers, and thickeners, which aren't really good for us. And so the Army, to its credit, is also moving in the same direction as consumers in seeking more healthful food. And it's worked to eliminate trans fats, reduce salt and sugar, and looking for ways to create a fresher and more nutritious product, even doing such things as sort of encapsulating, or microencapsulation of protein and other things so that those things stay fresh, even if a food is stored for 3 years.
Okay, so Matthew, before we go, there is one thing out of the sea rats I kind of miss. They had these little circular chocolates with crispy rice in them that I still to this day kind of crave. And I'm wondering if there is anything from your MREs that you would eat again if you could.
You know, funny you say that. I always liked the beans that were in there.
Were they, they were refried or?
No, they were like these like baked beans, and I would actually use the hot sauce that she was just talking about. I love those beans.
That's Army veteran and Brunswick farmer Matthew Rayford. We also heard from Anastasia Marx de Salcedo. She's the author of Combat Ready Kitchen, How the U.S. Military Shapes the Way You Eat. So after turkey, salad, and sandwiches and soup, you still have leftovers from your meal. What happens to those? Enter Compost Wheels. The Atlanta-based group takes food waste from homes and businesses and helps turn it into black gold, or as most of us know it, compost. GPB's Sean Powers followed a Compost Wheels delivery to learn how we can all play a larger role in urban agriculture.
So we are on West Paces Ferry up in Buckhead, about to pass Governor's Mansion, and we are on the residential pickup route. So I've been going around all morning to a number of other homes picking up their food waste. My name is Whit Whitmire. I am the head of hype, as we call it, for Compost Wheels, so primarily business development and marketing. So how it works is we provide our customers with a 5-gallon bucket that they keep wherever works best for them. Some keep it in their kitchen, some keep it out back, what have you. And they put their food waste in it, their scraps, their coffee grounds, eggshells, what have you. And then we come and pick it up every week. And then that's the material that I dump into these larger bins here in the back of the pickup. And I will be taken to today, specifically our partner farm, Freewheel Farm in Grant Park.
The destination is on your right.
So we are at our next compost pickup spot. So first what we gotta do is kind of get all set up here. So we grab a new bag because we always replace the bags that are in the buckets that we provide them, and then we also take our little hand scale thing because we want to weigh and record the amount of waste that we're collecting.
Don't you usually come earlier?
Earlier or later, one of the two. Yes,
whenever you get around to it.
Well, thank you so much.
Hi, I'm Harvey Hill. Good to see you.
And I'm Whit with Compost Wheels. Nice to meet you.
Good to meet
Thanks
you.
So much.
But I do think that it's nice to be saving this stuff, not putting it into our garbage, and also to have them making the fertilizer out of it. Because I'm worried about too much garbage and about the lack of place to put all of our garbage. And I'm also delighted to have things grown locally.
Okay. Good. How's it going, y'all?
Hey!
We're at Freewheel Farms, kind of main site, if you will, in Grant Park, over on Little Street. They're an organic producer of all kinds of delicious veggies.
Yeah, so I'm breaking up pumpkins. We're just past Halloween now, so we have a lot of pumpkins coming into the compost. My name is Brent Hall. I'm a farmer. I'm the owner and founder of Freewheel Farm. We use sawdust as our carbon source in the composting process, and we just mix it with our nitrogen source, which is all of the veggie waste, food scraps. It takes 16 to 20 weeks, I would say, from the time where it gets picked up from people's doorstep to the time when we're spreading it out into our field. The partnership with Compost Wheels has just been pretty amazing on many different levels. But yeah, having food waste picked up from the neighborhood and delivered here, you know, we're just closing that loop. And so we'll actually see produce that I can recognize, you know, certain specialty tops of veggies or something that I'm like, oh, or like the twist eyes that we use. I'm like, okay, that was our product that someone bought at the market, ate it, and then the scraps got tossed in their Compost Wheels bucket, got brought back here. We're composting it, putting it back in our beds, and growing more food with it.
That story was produced by GPB's Sean Powers. For photos from his day with Compost Wheels, visit gpbnews.org. Just ahead, a novel takes us back to a time when neighborhoods were segregated and black police officers were few and far between. First, though, interactions between police and African Americans now. This is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. It's On Second Thought. Tomorrow is Thanksgiving, and we want to hear about your favorite dishes that you might find on the table. Yams, maybe. The turkey, pies, ham. What is your favorite Thanksgiving dish? Call us and leave a message, and maybe a recipe, at 404-500-9457. You can also post on social media, but be sure to join us tomorrow at 9 a.m. for more. A recent NPR poll finds 60% of Black Americans say they or a family member have been stopped or treated unfairly by police. And in addition to that, 45% say they or a family member have been treated unfairly by the courts. Amir Muhammad of Atlanta says he wants his own experiences with police to be a learning experience for his children. Here he is with his son, Fahim.
And my name is Amir Muhammad, and I'm here with my son, Fahim Muhammad. You're only, how old are you now, 14?
Yes. Did you ever have any tense experiences with law enforcement?
I was in the ninth grade, and we had a basketball game, so I was fully dressed with my sweats, my shorts on. And so I was walking over a friend's house, and his mom was going to take us to the game. And this white police officer just rolls up really fast and stops his car and jumps out and just yells at me, "Where are you going?" So I looked at him, and I didn't answer him. And he said, "You heard me." I said, "Where are you going?" And I said, "Where does it look like I'm going?" He said, "Open your bag up." And I looked at him. I was like, "For what?" And he said, "I'm not going to tell you again." And he put his hand on his gun. So when I told my dad, told him the tone in which the conversation was, and he just told me, "Don't let it be easy for them to take you out." And so I learned as well to just let that cop have his way, and then we'll live to fight another day. That's just one of several incidents that I had. But that was like the first one when I was 14 years old.
At what point did you realize you wanted us as a family to talk about how we handle ourselves around police?
I had that conversation with you guys early, and you guys have seen some of the good and bad sitting in the back seat. The time where you were asleep and that cop made us wait for like an hour to write a ticket when we pulled in our own complex, and he made us wait an hour to write a ticket for really nothing, something that we ended up getting thrown out in court. So if you escalate a situation, then your kids are gonna grow up thinking that it's okay to escalate situations with police officers. And that's not good to teach them that, because if a police officer says, "Well, he looked like he was reaching for something," that's it. That's all they have to, I mean, it's been proven that they're going to get off from that. You know, when they go out on a day-to-day, you don't wake up saying, "My child is going to die from a police officer today." So they're going to imitate what they see you do. So if you ever are in that situation, you make that a positive, teachable moment. What was going through your mind when we talked about, you know, situations about race and with the police officers?
I was just thinking of stuff that I had seen before and then, like, went over my head at the time. And then now I knew exactly what it was.
And so does that make you worry, or now are you concerned about your safety with police?
It makes me cautious. Like, just walking past a police officer, I'm not going to get scared and worry and tense, but I'm just going to be cautious of what I do around police officers.
Just that, do you think that that is something that's fair?
Yeah, that's not fair at all. I mean, they are supposed to be the ones you are supposed to feel safe around, but it's the opposite with black people. It's like we feel less safe around them.
That was Amir Muhammad of Atlanta speaking with his 14-year-old son, Fahim. Their conversation was produced by GPB intern Maya Martin. In the Jim Crow South, black and white neighborhoods were separated by law. Some police departments added African-American officers to their squads to cover those black communities. Atlanta hired 8 men in 1948, but their authority was greatly limited. These officers inspired Thomas Mullen's novel, Dark Town. I talked to Thomas this year about the sequel, Lightning Men.
So Lightning Men refers to a group that existed in Atlanta. It was our very own homegrown fascist organization. They called themselves the Columbians. They dressed in Nazi brown shirts, complete with SS lightning bolt patches on their sleeve, designed after the Nazi stormtrooper lightning bolt. And they made it a point of showing up in neighborhoods where African-Americans had bought a house in previously white-only neighborhoods, and showing up to intimidate them and start fights. They recruited other adherents at mills around town, and they finally got shut down in the late 40s when they went even further than that and advocated overthrowing the state government.
And what was interesting to me was that I would have assumed they would have been in league with, or at least friendly with, the KKK, but your books suggest that was not the case.
Yeah, there are all sorts of different variations of white supremacy. And you had the Ku Klux Klan, obviously, and then you had the Columbians. The KKK kind of looked down on the Columbians as these goofy kid dropouts who were a little too enamored with Hitler. Remember, this is after World War II. This is after we fought a war to defeat fascism. And a few years later, here we have a Nazi-style group operating in Atlanta. So the Klan kind of looked down their noses at them. But then you also had neighborhood associations that looked down at the Klan, even though they really wanted the same thing, which was to keep blacks out of white neighborhoods.
I mean, it makes it sound like we're talking about a history book, and really this is a mystery slash thriller at its heart. The problem for me is that it's really hard to talk about any plot points without spoiling, because you get a spoiler almost from the very beginning of the novel. The character of the first person who gets out of prison and is released is someone that I can't say who that is, because who he
is, that's true,
is important. But he says this one thing, and I want to read it. The character named Jeremiah, he's just out of prison, and they have the cops have set up a system whereby they can somebody's released from prison can be sent back almost immediately to prison. And he says, "Why do they act this way? I don't understand this world, not this world meaning the outside as opposed to prison, but this world meaning everything." Does that sentiment change at all by the end?
Maybe.
As a symbol, I guess.
Maybe not for him, but I mean, all the characters are trying to understand what's going on in this crazy world. And it was a time of great change. I mean, it was right before a lot of the seminal victories of the civil rights movement that we learn about in school. Like the Montgomery bus boycott is going to be in 55, and Brown versus Board of Education is going to be in 54, but this book is set in 50. So all of those currents and threads are still going on at that time, but nothing's happened yet. And within the black community at this time, there's also a sense of disappointment. People thought there were going to be a lot of changes with World War II, since, you know, we fought a war to defeat fascism, and African-American newspapers thought that we should also be fighting to overthrow Jim Crow at the same time. They called it the Double V campaign, the Double V campaign for victory over fascism and victory over Jim Crow. But that hadn't quite happened yet. And so I think there was a lot of confusion going on all sides. The world had just gone through so much change with the Depression, with the war, and everybody was kind of wondering what's going to happen next.
Is there a point in there where you're, as a novelist, are imagining how these sort of backroom deals had to be made? And it's one where they're sort of, they're negotiating where the lines of segregation will be drawn in a neighborhood. And it struck me because many people think of the Atlanta Way, capital Atlanta, capital Way, as something to be proud of. That's how Atlanta has escaped a lot of the racial turmoil that has beset other cities like Los Angeles or Detroit or New York. But in your book, the Atlanta Way kind of feels a little bit gross.
Interesting.
It feels a little bit like people simply not taking a stand or avoiding conflict in order to keep the peace when they really needed to have the conflict. And that was all coming out of your imagination? Or really my question is, how much did you find out about how these deals were made or not?
I tried to make that as based on fact as possible. So I am a novelist. This is fiction. And so I'm going to exploit things for tension and suspense as much as I can. But I want the surrounding world and the politics to be as dead on accurate as possible. And you'll create my little fictional events within that structure. And the Atlanta Way, it can look that way. It can look a little backward looking back through time, especially, you know, after the mid-60s when you had this generational change within the civil rights leadership and, you know, a younger generation that came of age in about 60, 61, 62, saying, like, we're tired of the way that our fathers are going about it, this incrementalism, this asking for crumbs off the white man's table. We need to push harder. And, you know, obviously it's easy to agree with that now. In 1950, it was more complicated because, you know, Atlanta was only 40 some odd years removed from a race riot where whites rioted and attacked blacks and drove them out of downtown. So for black community leaders at that time, you know, they were working hard to win concessions from the white majority, concessions like black officers hired in 1948, concessions like allowing certain neighborhoods that had previously been all white, you know, opening those up to African Americans. And that's a scene in the book that you're referring to where some black community leaders sit down with white community leaders and try to negotiate, okay, well, where can black families move into safely? And looking back on it now, and one of the characters in the book, a young police officer, he's angered by this. He's like, well, we're bartering away where we can live. This is America. We should be able to live wherever we want. That's the perspective of Officer Lucius Boggs, who's kind of sickened by these negotiations that he observes. But his father, Reverend Boggs, who I see as a contemporary of Martin Luther King Sr., you know, the older wave of leadership at that time, you know, he feels like we're doing what we can to avoid another race riot. We're doing what we can to make things better for our people while avoiding violence. And you know, I've worked hard to get this far. I don't want to hear you criticizing me. And that was a generational conflict that, you know, we would see more of in the years ahead.
So I want to read, I alluded earlier to the white detective who decides he's putting his family in danger by helping African Americans. He doesn't want to do this anymore. And his family situation gets very complicated in this book in a really interesting way. But it says, if any Negro officer ever asked another favor of him, he would decline. He wouldn't spit in their faces, no, but neither would he take a single risk for their cause ever again. He had his own battles to fight, and he couldn't afford to weaken himself by associating with the troubles that shadowed their every step. How much did you try to imagine yourself in the same position? To what extent did you think to yourself, well, what would I have done?
Well, first I should mention that passage you read is very late in the book. So a lot has gone on to get him to that point. And when I wrote this book and when I wrote the previous book, Darktown, you know, I was aware of the fact that in a lot of other books about race written by white people or films about race, starring a lot of white Hollywood actors, there's this character that kind of gets created of the white savior, where even if it's a story about civil rights in which you would think African American should be starring, or at the very least playing a very pivotal role. Weirdly, through some alchemy, the story winds up being about, you know, saving the soul of the white people, or the white people finally stepping up and doing the right thing. And although that is important, I didn't want that to happen with my book. And so there is this character of Dennis Rakestraw. He goes by Rake. He's a white cop, and he wants to be better than a lot of the white cops around him. He's not a violent thug. He's not a racist. He was raised in a household where you didn't use racial epithets and things like that. So he wants to do better, and he wants to see the black cops succeed. But one of the reasons he wants to see them succeed is because if the black cops succeed and the city hires more of them, then the city will have enough black cops to patrol all the black neighborhoods. And
he
white cops, like, great, we'll never have to go to a black... Yeah, exactly. Because even progressive-minded whites back then still had a hard time imagining a world without segregation. So he's being pushed in the previous book and in this book to try to do the right thing and kind of cross the color line to help.
Did you know the end of the book before you started writing?
Gosh, that's a good question. I don't know if I remember anymore. Usually I have a pretty good idea of where I'm going, but I don't know exactly how I'm going to get there. So there's a few scenes towards the end that I had to figure some things out, especially with a crime novel where you have various intersecting plot lines. You want to make sure they make sense. And sometimes I'll be writing a book and I'll think, okay, this character is going to have a deep, dark secret. And I don't know what it is yet. And as I'm writing, I'll eventually figure it out, or I'll be doing some research and I'll discover some interesting thing that happened. I was like, ooh, I'm going to borrow that. So I think I knew most of it, but some of it was stuff that I worked out as I went.
And is this part of a trilogy?
I'm not going to limit myself to three. I think it's kind of fun. When I had the idea for Darktown, which was set in 48 when the city first hired its 8 black cops, I was struck by the fact that it's right before the civil rights movement really takes off and that so much is going to change in Atlanta, in the South, and in America over the next 20 years. And as I was writing Darktown, it was getting longer and longer, and I was coming up with more subplots and more characters, and I quickly realized, you know, this could easily become like an 800-page doorstop of a novel if I wasn't careful. And I didn't want that to happen because not many people want to read 800-page novels. So I held some things back. So there were things in Lightning Men that I had initially been writing to go into Darktown that I later decided to pull back and save for a later book. So I don't have a magic number in mind, but I think there's a lot of different stories worth telling. And I think it'd be interesting to see what happens to some of these officers. You know, in 55, when the Montgomery bus boycott's going on and Martin Luther King Jr., a native Atlantan, becomes a national figure. What happens in 1960 when King moves to Atlanta at the same time that this younger generation of civil rights activist, you know, takes over and there are more demonstrations in Atlanta than there had been before? You know, what happens in the mid-60s? Like, it's interesting to trace the evolution of Atlanta and the evolution of our country, and you marry that to crime stories sort of as a... like the spoonful of sugar that makes maybe a reader able to embrace what can otherwise be difficult, heavy material.
Have you heard from any cops after they read Darktown? Did you hear from actual officers?
I've spoken with a few officers. I'm not sure how many I've spoken with who'd read the book first.
Or admitted it.
Yeah. But I've spoken, I mean, a lot of people have been interested in it. And when I've given talks, some cops have come up to me afterwards, or people who were former officers or whose dad or uncle or cousin or sister was a cop and have shared different stories they've told, not just in Atlanta, but in other parts of the country, and how, you know, different police departments have been integrated better than others. And in some cities, it took a long time before white and black cops could work together well.
That's Atlanta-based author Thomas Mullen. Mullen's author of the bestseller Darktown, and his latest novel is the sequel, Lightning Men. That's our show for today, but we'd love to hear from you. How do you approach sensitive issues when you're talking to your kids or your family members, things like conflicts with police? How do you talk about those? Call and leave a message at 404-500-9457. You can also find us on Twitter. For today, that's on Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headlee. Have a great day.